5 p.m. on a beautiful Wednesday. Welcome to the American Hit Radio program on WHPC 90.3 FM.
It's gorgeous.
It is gorgeous out there. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well. Going to be with you for the next hour for our typical American Hit Radio program. It's becoming sort of typical anyway, at least in terms of like a new feature that we began a few months back, where we call, which I'm calling the Alternative Top 40, picking albums that are among, I feel, some of my favorite albums of all time that did not make the top 40 charts, that I feel nevertheless deserve to be remembered and perhaps included as at least the alternative top 40 albums right now. These are albums that I think that have longevity, or at least deserve to have longevity. Now, I made a list. This is number 17. Now, we've already covered 16 albums on this list. I'm going to try to hit a full 500. So we're just going to go and go and go.
Ambitious.
And we're doing all of these chronologically. Now, the artists we've covered so far include Muddy Waters, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bob Dylan, Solomon Burke, The Ronettes, John Coltrane, B.B. King, Them, Otis Redding, Paul Butterfield Blues Band, The Who. Obviously, you can see these are obviously bands that deserved the longevity.
Sure. They deserve to be honored.
Yes. The Monks were after that. Them made it a second time for their second album. James Carr, The Mothers of Invention, for their first album. The last album that we did, number 16, was John Mayall's Blues Breakers. And now for number 17, which came out in August of 1966, we are going to look at an album entitled The Psychedelic Sound of the 13th Floor Elevators.
Oh, I love them.
Crazy. Believe it or not, this is where everything kind of changes in terms of like our list and this chronological list. Because up until now, you'll notice, and most of the artists that I covered were very, you can see, I wouldn't say traditional, but there's a lot of blues-based artists, a lot of R&B, stuff that was more or less based in something that had some history. This is where things change. This is the very first time that an album was released that used the word psychedelic to explain its content. So it was a relatively new word, and it sort of gave birth right here. The band, consisting mostly of guitarist and lead singer Rocky Erickson, Rocky spelled R-O-K-Y, Stacy Sutherland, another guitar player, and an electric jug player named Tommy Hall.
I'm guessing they invented that electric jug instrument themselves.
Right. That is like so much of what makes this record like, you know, crazy fun to listen to. But the whole, you know, basically the whole idea of this psychedelic music coming out of Austin, Texas, and Texas of all places, it just goes to show you. I mean, Austin has a reputation for being like, you know, a bit of a cutting edge sort of a town.
Yeah, keep Austin weird.
Absolutely. Well, it was weird all the way back in 66 when this came up. I mean, this is before the scene really even hit in San Francisco. It predates that. That's how early this is. So there was one single from the album. The album starts out with that hit single. So let's get the show started with hearing this incredible, listen to the vocals on this track, this incredible tune called You're Gonna Miss Me.
You're gonna look around and you'll find
That's one of those tracks that was eventually compiled on an album called Nuggets, the original artifacts of the first psychedelic era. And that album pretty much went down in history for compiling what is essentially garage rock, American garage rock, all the bands that had begun to crop up around the nation after the spate of British invasion bands and the influence that they had had on youth to basically go out and form their own rock and roll bands. There was a bunch of bands like that coming in specifically in the Austin area in Texas, which had been influenced by it, which is eventually where the 13th Floor Elevators came from, a band that definitely had that perfect garage sound, but with a weird, mystical, drug-bent influence, something that was really like gonna scare the bejesus out of any other generation. But it was so weird, people didn't quite know what to make of it. You got to realize this is before like things like psychedelic drugs were even illegal,
right?
You know, nobody didn't know
what they were.
Nobody even knew what it was. Nobody knew what psychedelic meant. Just, you know, this song came out and it wasn't a big hit. It was, I think, went to number 55 on the Billboard charts, so it didn't really quite make the top 40. Mostly a regional hit in the Texas area. But it had an influence that reached far outside of its immediate area in Texas because of the fact that it was youth music with a weird bent towards some sort of obvious anti-authoritarian stance. There was obviously something's going on here, and you're going to hear it as it comes up in the lyrics of some of the songs from the album where... I would say that some of the songs actually seem to, like, you know, more or less flat out reference psychedelic drugs. But listen for yourself. Let's keep playing our way through the album because I want to be sure I get this entire record played today. Second track from the same album on side one. This song is called Roller Coaster.
Thank you.
crazy.
Oh, yeah.
See, I mean, these are not the first guys that ever tripped. I mean, the whole electric Kool-Aid acid test thing was going on. The Grateful Dead were together. I mean, the band formed at around this time as well. What makes the 13th Floor Elevators so different is that they were very verbose about it. And they were not at all trying to hold back. I mean, they were, you know, these songs are essentially commercials.
Yeah, they were embracing the philosophy.
For psychedelic drugs. Yeah, I mean, open up your mind and let everything come on through and look at the world through brand new eyes. Let it happen to you. I mean, those words are lifted right out of that song.
Right.
Now, you know, these guys, you know, they're in Austin. They somehow got involved in the psychedelic scene, are totally enamored with it. Now they start playing around Austin, Houston, and Dallas. And in their wake, other bands start popping up around Texas. And all of a sudden, you know, gone are like, you know, like the McCoys, names like that. Now all of a sudden you got names like, you know, The Wig, The Baby Cakes, Shiva's Headband, The Conqueror, you know, Red Crayola, Bubble Puppy. These are all bands that were coming up out of Texas after the 13th Floor Elevators passed through. It began to become something. And soon, of course, they ended up, I mean, they were on TV for, you know, it was essentially the cities outside of Texas. It was mostly the San Francisco Bay Area that grabbed onto the band, parts of Miami and Detroit as well. Their appeal was regional, but it was definitely in the places where there was like cultures that were going to be the first ones to accept this alternative drug culture that was beginning to infiltrate youth. And these guys were right on the cutting edge of it, for better or worse. But at the time, it didn't. I mean, none of these songs make it seem frightening. They make it seem as though it's actually something which is really true. They make it seem like it's a Timothy Leary experience.
Exactly, yeah. You're going to get enlightened.
Right. It's an enlightenment thing. We'll get into that a little bit more with the band title and everything else. But here's one more track from the album. This is called Splash, Now I'm Home. lot of people, my age anyway, think that this is where rock and roll began to pretty much branch off into becoming something that was completely unique. You could say the birth of album rock more or less happened with the birth of psychedelia. But when you would get bands deliberately making tracks that were not necessarily meant to be played on AM radio. And you could say this is a part of that. I just got a really cool call from a listener, Vince Mistretta. Thank you very much for pointing this out, Vince. He was checking out on Wikipedia some information about the record, and he noted that the producer, the production is credited to Leland Rogers, and that is Kenny Rogers' brother, which is like, what?
Pretty crazy.
That is totally nuts. Now, in a way, it doesn't surprise me too much, because if you think back now, if you think how Kenny Rogers' career began himself, he began as a psychedelic artist.
That's right.
Kenny Rogers in the first edition, if I remember, their first hit was Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition
That's
Was
right.
In. A total song about a drug trip. So it's not a reach. It must, you know, I totally accept the fact that that would be Kenny Rogers' brother. I'll try to confirm that for sure, but it's pretty wild. I mean, this is a band that, you know, when these guys ended up going to San Francisco, they were playing with people like Quicksilver Messenger Service and Moby Grape and, you know, Grace Slick and the Great Society. And they were all pretty much in this thing together, you know. But it really was a matter of just how deep into it you were willing to basically go and how much you were willing to commit. I mean, all these bands that I just mentioned are bands that were deeply associated with the psychedelic drug scene. You know, my God, Moby Grape, good example. You've got, you know, some people who have really come out of that band with, you know, with some serious issues as far as like, basically drug being fractured by drugs.
Yeah.
The acid is one thing that if you take too much of it, you really might change you. Just, you know, ask Syd Barrett, you know.
Ask Rocky.
Or from, you know, like I said, you know, Skip Spence, who was one of the songwriters for Moby Grape, who ended up becoming a little bit, you know, cracked afterwards. And of course, the leading, after Syd, would be Rocky Erickson. Rocky Erickson is.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
About 15 minutes ago.
I missed all that.
Oh.
There's a great movie about the life of Rocky Erickson that I would recommend you see. I don't remember exactly what it's called, but I'm sure that it's easily found. Yeah, you're just looking for a documentary on Rocky Erickson because it's amazing how he got railroaded. We'll get into that a little bit later on, too. But let's keep playing tracks from this album. Side one of the LP. The album is called The Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevator, something which was incredibly exciting in 1966. Where'd all that paisley come from all of a sudden? Here's track four from side one. This is called Reverberation.
Back again. You only know you have to go.
Tommy Hall, the jug player for the band, actually wrote liner notes. And imagine just being so open. I mean, like I said, it wasn't illegal at this point in time. And it was really believed by the people who were taking LSD or peyote, you know, whatever, anything that was going to basically elicit a psychedelic reaction.
Right.
It was really believed that this was something that was going to help you to achieve a higher consciousness,
right,
or a sense of enlightenment. There was a distinct difference between those who were new because they had taken it and those who didn't know and could never know unless they did take it, because you could only be enlightened if you had bothered to, if you would allow yourself to succumb to the experience. So it was one of these things that was really, you know, kind of frightening on the one hand for anybody who was, you know, basically trying to, this was where you get that whole thing about peer pressure and drugs, because it really was, quite frankly, that is more or less what was happening in the middle of the 60s. I mean, Tommy's liner notes, the jug player, says, quote, you know, on the cover, that, you know, he advocated chemical agents such as LSD as a gateway to a higher non-Aristotelian state of consciousness. here's the last track on side one called Don't Fall Down. Halfway there already. playing tracks from an album called The Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators. I'm going to try to get the entire album in its entirety. This is album number 17 in our series, which we are calling the Alternative Top 40. Great albums that missed the charts, but here, you know, years and years and years later, you look back at them and you can recognize how influential they were in a cultural, in this sense, absolutely in a cultural sense, and in a musical sense as well. How this had pretty much done an awful lot to spawn what really came out of the San Francisco scene, even as it predated an awful lot of that. Fairly incredible. Now, a lot can be made of the band's name, 13th Floor Elevators. You could take it on a very simple level, which is to say that it is noticed that most high rises don't have a 13th floor because it was considered bad luck. So it was just sort of like not really so much a psychedelic name as a name that basically is kind of like an alternative name, a weird way of saying, okay, there's no elevator goes to the 13th floor, so we'll be the 13th floor elevators.
Right.
But there's more to it than that. And you just mentioned it, Heidi, that the Illuminati symbol that's on the dollar bill. I don't know really much about all, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, weird stuff about underground organizations and what some of these things mean and who belongs to what organization. But
right, like the Freemasons or whatever.
Exactly. But it is that there's a symbol of a pyramid with the eye on top. I mean, if you look at the cover of the album of the 13th Floor Elevators, it's, you know, besides all the weird, the psychedelic swirling colors that are all around it, circles an eye, just one eye. And then you think about the fact that, you know, the eye is a symbol of enlightenment, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And in that triangle that we're talking about, that pyramid of enlightenment has got, like, allegedly, as I understand it, the 13th, the peak of the pyramid of enlightenment is the 13th floor of that pyramid.
Oh, okay.
And that is where the all-seeing eye or the third eye sits.
Yes.
And this is exactly, and Rocky Erickson pretty much defines that, the sound of the band is where the pyramid meets the eye, as he put it. And the number 13th, of course, you know, refers to, in a lot of ways, it has a lot of symbolic imagery regarding surrounding it, basically around the unknown. It symbolizes the gateway to the mysterious source of creation, as I'm reading in Wikipedia, or the eye of the vortex, the eye of God. All of these things. Basically, the way you activate this eye, of course, if you could allegedly do it through yogic practices, that it does something with the pineal gland or something. I guess that's one way to do it naturally. But you could also do it, obviously, through mescaline, mushrooms, or LSD. So this is where the band may basically is saying that they could serve as elevators for their audience's consciousness to bring them up to that level of enlightenment. So it's, on that sense, the name's very, very, very heavy. So it's hard to say if they could have meant all of that initially, but I would say that it's certainly, maybe all of, you know, basically the taking of the drugs began to make them realize that there was all this imagery that surrounded the name, the perfect thing for them to use. So you're a track from Side 2, one of my favorite songs from the album. This is called Fire Engine. We'll be right back. More imagery there, of course. Climb the ladder of your mind. Take you there in my fire engine. Now, up until this point, it's rather interesting how the album is laid out. You know, of course, on vinyl, when it first came out, side one, side two, and all that. Fire Engine was the first track on side two. Now, on side one, Rocky Erickson is a credited songwriter, one of the credited songwriters on each song, on every song on side one. You're Gonna Miss Me is credited to him alone, but a lot of the songs have him teaming up with other members of the band, most often Tommy Hall, the jug player. And he also is credited for writing Fire Engine. But from this point on, it's the other band members who are credited with the songs. So the rest of from this point forward, Rocky's not one of the credited songwriters. Just so I think that's a rather unusual layout for the way that they formulated the album. But let's play one of the tracks. And the next track, written by Tommy Hall, and I think it was it Scott Sutherland? Not exactly sure of the first name, but it's credited to, Hall Sutherland. One of the first songs we're going to be hearing that is not a Rocky composition or that he's not credited for writing. This is called Through the Rhythm. See, I fooled you. Not really, because what I said is the truth, but you would kind of get the feeling that, okay, if Rocky is not writing it, maybe the psychedelic thing is going to fade away, as though he was like the main progenitor of all of that psychedelic stuff in the band, but it's obviously not true at all. Well, you know, this is very much a band collaboration.
Judging by the liner notes.
Right, and by what Tommy said. I mean, yeah, Rocky might have been the first serious victim of taking too much acid. And by the way, I alluded to his life story earlier that I was going to get into it, but I'm going to save that story for another show because I know that I've got a second 13th Floor Elevators album that I've got to have covered in this series of How Music Changed. And since that story is going to be more relevant to that point in their history, I ought to save it for when we're playing
okay,
that
fair
album.
Fair enough.
So I'll
something to look forward to.
Right, exactly. You can hold off on that until we get to that album, which won't be too long because it's only within a few months of us doing this, I'm sure. But the thing about the thing is, you know, they basically put it where they weren't just posturing. I mean, when they were in the recording studio, they were absolutely totally under the influence of LSD. This album was recorded. They basically, it was, you know, they pretty much demanded that was what they had to do.
That must have been like herding cats.
Can you imagine? All of their live shows were played under the influence of LSD. They would take it before they played live. They would take it before they recorded. It was just... It was
what they do?
It was their lifestyle. It wasn't really just something that they were doing for kicks.
Right.
It really genuinely was about a lifestyle for these guys at this point in time.
They thought they were opening up their minds.
Exactly. Here's another track from side two. This is called You Don't Know. That track, along with the next two that I am about to play, are credited to somebody named Powell St. John. Now, Powell St. John wasn't an actual playing member of the band, but he was in the inner circle with the band and was a songwriter. So when he was basically on the trips with these guys, he would come up with this, these are the songs that he came up with. Basically writing about the trip experience as it's happening, which became the song, which became something that the band would eventually record. So he's actually, you know, became a significant songwriter for the band, writing that track, You Don't Know, as well as this song I'm about to play called Kingdom of Heaven. So in the interest of time, I'm going to want to read what I wrote about this because I have an essay that goes with each of these albums and it might not fit otherwise, so I can do it over this particular track. If you look back from here chronologically, you might notice that the lion's share of the best popular music that was chosen for this project was blues-centric. That's not an accident. That was the zeitgeist. But look at how fast things changed. Never underestimate the influence of drugs, psychedelia, and the summer of love. Psychedelic influence happens so quickly that it's hard to understand from a modern perspective. Even purist blues artists fell under its spell for a while. The Rolling Stones, the Yardbirds, Cream, and Eric Burdon all changed their approach to music sometime in 1967. Before any of this happened, though, there was the 13th floor elevators. Here in the middle of 1966, before most of America was even aware that an active drug culture was fermenting, along comes a band writing songs about the virtues of LSD. Each track plays like a Paisley radio commercial, expounding the joys of an expanded consciousness in a musical style that is, by definition, far out. The band features an electric jug player, for Christ's sakes. Rocky Erickson, the group's leader, with jug player Tommy Hall and guitarist Stacy Sutherland, wrote songs that combined American garage punk with psychedelic ruminations. Most of the other garage rock bands of the time, the Remains, the Sonics, the Standells, Count Five, Paul Revere and the Raiders, et al., each came up with a handful of awesome tracks, but they had a hard time coming up with sufficient material to carry an entire album. Too often, garage punk bands would flesh out their long players with sloppy cover tunes of early rock and roll or R&B classics. Essentially, garage punk was a singles genre until the release of the psychedelic sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators. Erickson and his bandmates concocted an album consisting completely of original songs that more or less marks the starting point for the drug counterculture that would soon ensue. Perhaps more than anywhere else in rock and roll history, the chronological placement of this album is incredibly significant to recognizing its almost clairvoyant innovation. This album was released one summer before Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The Grateful Dead didn't yet exist at this point in time. LSD was still legal when this album was released. The 13th Floor Elevators were complete freaks of their era, and you can hear them celebrating their sense of discovery on nearly every track of this remarkable record. The window pane didn't stay open very long, but these guys jumped through before knowing what they might find on the other side. It's mind-boggling to think how many other people soon made that very same trip. Here's Monkey Island, second-to-last album on side two of the album. I'm on the river, don't what a short, strange trip that has been. We ate up that hour in no time at all. I can't believe it. Just barely enough time to play the last track on the album. Quite obviously, let it be known that, of course, Heidi and I, we are not endorsing drug use at all, but we certainly are endorsing the 13th Floor Elevators' first album called The Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators.
Yeah,
hope you enjoyed the show. Here's the last track. Again, one of my absolute favorites from this album. It's called Tried to Hide. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back on Friday. See you then.
Yeah.